Welcome to Worlds Apart. An old Russian saying has it that once you have a reason, finding a pretext is only a matter of time, including finding a pretext for a war. The animosity between Russia and the United States has been building for a number of years. In fact, one could argue that it never really disappeared, just diminished with the end of the Cold War. How far can the current conflict over Ukraine take it, and what does it mean for the rest of the world? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Fuad Izadi, Professor of Political Communications at the University of Tehran. Professor Izadi, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, in one of your recent articles, you suggested that this geopolitical rivalry over Ukraine that we all are now observing and some are even participating in, just like the problem of Iran's supposed malicious nuclear intentions, is essentially an artificial problem. It was deliberately created by the Americans to justify their intentional geopolitical, geoeconomic hostility towards those countries. Does Washington even need a pretext to do what it set its mind on doing?
You know, when it comes to Russia, I think they do, because it's not very easy to pressure Russia. When it comes to Iran, they can always threaten to take Iran's case to the UN Security Council. With Russia having a veto power in the Security Council, that's not going to work out. With Iran, they accuse Iran of trying to make a nuclear bomb. With Russia, Russia has a lot of nuclear bombs already, so that is not going to work with Russia. So if United States wants to fight Russia, and they do want to do that, as you said, they need to find an excuse. I think that is why they don't want the war in Ukraine to finish. Because there is a settlement, then you are not going to be able to use Ukraine to put pressure on Russia. And that is why, if you go back a few years ago, the United States did not want the Minsk agreement to go through, because that would have solved all the problems, and then Ukraine would not have been able to be used as a stage to attack Russia or cause difficulty.
But Professor, the problem with that rationale is that the war in Ukraine is putting pressure not only on Russia, but pretty much on the rest of the world, because we see that in the form of skyrocketing food and fuel prices. And many, many countries that have nothing to do with Russia or Ukraine are feeling the pinch. Now, you've been pretty open about your views that you believe that this conflict in Ukraine is changing the current world order and that it's pushing it towards a more multipolar arrangement where different powers are going to compete with each other. Do you think that new arrangement, whatever it's going to be, do you think it's going to be more or less violent than what we have at the moment?
You know, we are going through a transition. We had a bipolar world order after Second World War. You had the United States and the Soviet Union. Then the end of Soviet Union, Americans thought they're going to have a unipolar world with the United States leading that, being the only superpower. People like Francis Fukuyama talked about the end of history. There is a debate among scholars whether what Americans wanted to do was actually achieved. There are some people who believe that Americans never could establish a unipolar world. There are some people who believe they did it for maybe 15 or 18 years from the fall of the Soviet Union until 2007 or 2008. So there's a debate on that. But what we know now is that the world is moving towards a multipolar system. And during this transition, you're going to see more difficulties. So you're going to see countries trying to find ways of improving their chances of actually being a greater power when the new world order is actually settled down.
Now, Professor, as we move to away from this Western-centered system, or as this system continues to disintegrate, do you think there will ever be a moment when countries like, let's say, Iran, Russia, Venezuela, and other nations that have had an experience of being sanctioned for a prolonged period of time, do you think they will come to a point of appreciating that experience because it made them more self-sufficient? Could it save them some pain as this transition period continues? Because this transition, I assume we would agree, is going to be painful for many members of the international system.
You know, Iran has been under sanctions since 1979, since the revolution. So Iran is used to sanctions. And that experience of being under sanctions and also continuing to live and continuing to prosper. Iran has done a lot in terms of building things that Iran needs because of sanctions. A lot of especially high-tech devices were not able to be sent to Iran. So Iranian scientists, Iranian manufacturers managed to build a lot of things internally instead of relying on outside sources. It's going to be more difficult to do that. But once you do that, then you're going to be self-sufficient. That is why, for example, Iran's military does not depend on weapons from outside. They make all the weapons that they want internally. And that is going to be important, as you said, during this transition time. Sanctions are a tool in U.S. foreign policy to cause difficulties for countries that are not following U.S. dictates. And the more self-sufficient you are, the less those sanctions are going to hurt you, and the more cooperation you're seeing among sanctioned countries. So, for example, we had a huge Russian delegation in Tehran just a few days ago. Iran-Russia relations are going to be much more now since there are common problems and common enemies. And I think the same thing is going to be true with other countries that the U.S. feels that they need to put pressure on.
Now, you mentioned before that this, if we accept that this indirect confrontation between Russia and the West, or Russia and the United States, was intentional, was just a matter of finding the right pretext, do you think all those ripple effects that the global economy is witnessing, or and the American economy is also witnessing, do you think that was sort of factored in? Because the Americans are now facing unprecedented inflation, which is adding to already pre-existing social tensions, and all of that on the eve of crucial midterm elections. The Biden administration's approval ratings are among the lowest in history. So do you think all of that was also, you know, part of the plan?
You know, you may have heard that Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has called the U.S. government a mafia regime. And when you study how the U.S. government works, you realize that the people's interest, the U.S. Citizens' interest, or the citizens of Europe interest, or other people's interest, is not really the first priority. The first priority for American politicians is to get reelected, and they get reelected by raising millions of dollars. And big oil companies, big weapons manufacturers, industries that benefit from war are quite happy. You look at what they are doing in the U.S. stock market in the last 3 months. And so that is going to be a priority. Whether American people will suffer or not is going to be a concern, but it's going to be the second or the third concern of people like President Biden and other people who are in the White House. And that is why causing the current situation, and then they obviously realize that not only people in the United States, but people in Asia, in Africa, in other places are going to suffer. But Americans could care less about suffering of the people. What they care about, the American officials, is basically benefiting this mafia regime that they're running in Washington.
But Professor Izadi, let me challenge you on this point, because we both come from countries with, I think, a fairly large reservoir of resilience. You know, we've been exposed to hardship before, but the American populations, by and large, are used to living pretty comfortable lives. And I have a lot of friends in the United States who have been used to comforts and who bought into all this ideological rhetoric about freedoms and how the American government or the American society, the American way of life is exceptional. But now when they have to pay what they have to pay at the gas pump, I think that their perceptions are changing very rapidly. And you can easily see that across the polls, that the sort of the social attitudes in the United States are changing, maybe not dramatically yet, but a lot of people are actually questioning whether what they've been told by the authorities is indeed supported by the reality. Do you think it's still business as usual in the United States this time around? Or do you think perhaps they may have been changed in the collective, not in their leadership, but in the way the collective, the society, perceives what leadership is doing?
You know, that's a risk that the U.S. government took. They wanted to do this very much. If you look at, for example, a RAND report — RAND is a think tank in the United States — they published a report in 2019, 3 years ago, talking about — this is the title of that report — they say, overreaching and unbalancing Russia. So especially the Democrats in the United States after the 2016 election really wanted to cause serious harm to Russia as a country, Russians as a nation. And that was a very important goal. And the American officials, you know, they rely on the propaganda machine that the corporate media in the United States provides. So, and then by shutting down independent outlets that are not controlled by the media, U.S. media, like RT, by censoring the content that is not in line with their foreign policy goals. And then I'm sure you and your friends in the United States.
A few years prior to that, because the Iranian network was also essentially ostracized and taken off international airwaves because it was broadcasting something that wasn't in line with the American mainstream.
But I tell you, it took a couple of years for the U.S. to go through that process. And they did to Russian outlets in a few days, what they did to Iran in a couple of years. It took them just a few days to attack the Russian media outlets. So going back to your question, there's this risk that the American officials took, that they thought that maybe the corporate media in the United States would justify all the harm that's going to be faced by the American people. And to be honest with you, I don't know whether this level of propaganda is going to actually work or not. You have a segment of the American population that is realizing what the Biden administration is doing is harmful to the United States as a country. And there's a segment that is basically following the propaganda that's being fed to them.
I guess we will have to wait and see, but for the time being, let's take a very short break. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
During the Second World War, in Nazi-occupied Poland, Volhynia was a farming region. Today it's part of Ukraine. Between 1943 and 1945, members of the Ukrainian insurgent army led by Stepan Bandera massacred thousands of Poles in Volhynia in a diabolical ethnic cleansing process. The murders were particularly horrific and brutal. Villages were burned and property looted. The Volhynia massacre is without doubt one of the bloodiest episodes in Polish-Ukrainian history. Why are Ukrainian politicians still reluctant to talk about these events? How do modern-day Ukraine and Poland view this tragedy of the past? And why does the memory of Volhynia still divide people?
Ежедневно стреляют, скупрокалиберных снайпера работают.
Thousands of people still live in small towns and villages that have become the new front line.
Что хотят, то и творят.
They call this area the gray zone.
Обстреляли Александровку с пулемета.
Вот не надо гильзы только высыпать.
Хочу.
Был обстрел шахты 10. Убило человека, сгорел дом. Тогда 7 или 8 домов сгорело. И были люди ранены. Все было.
Положи.
22 6 обстрел Александровки убило мужчину.
Начался сильный обстрел. Ложилось вот там на дороге, там людей во дворе ложилось.
Погиб мой сын, невестка и парень. Трое сиротами остались.
Ну, это каждый день такое бывает, удивляться нечем.
Безнаказанность порождает беззаконие, оно так и есть. Их никто ничем не наказывает, они себя ведут так.
Apart with Fuad Izadi, professor of political communications at the University of Tehran. Professor, before the break, we were talking about the risk that the Biden administration took in trying to overextend and unbalance Russia. And I think it was Aesop, an ancient Greek storyteller, who warned about being careful for what one wishes for, lest it come true. I think it could be argued that the Biden administration did that more to itself than to Russia, overextending and unbalancing. But anyway, do you think they may initiate more geopolitical flare-ups while in office, for example, with China over Taiwan? Or do you think they've got enough on their plate for the time being?
You know, Americans are capable of doing all the things that you mentioned. And I actually was quite surprised when I listened to Tony Blinken's speech about China just a few days ago. And there were people in the United States that were arguing that China could play a role by helping Russia fight this level of aggression that's coming from the United States. And there were some people who were arguing that a good policy is actually causing difficulties between Russia and China. And when I listened to Mr. Blinken, I realized that they are actually making a decision of putting pressure on China at the same time that they're fighting Russia, which is, I don't think it's a very smart decision, but American officials are also known for making not very smart decisions in the past.
Yeah. Well,
and the result is that I think the Chinese realize that if Americans succeed in their campaign against Russia, China is going to be next. Okay. And that's very important.
Now, on the other hand, the worse the situation with Russia over Ukraine, the more impetus there seems to be for the resumption of the Iranian nuclear talks. They are in slow motion again. And while I understand what's in it for the Americans, after all, Iran is a large oil producer, and we already mentioned the the discontent of the American voters when they come to the gas stations. What I cannot understand is what's in it for Iran? Why would your country need another agreement with the Americans that could be easily revoked by the previous administration, by this next administration?
That is why you have a lot of Iranian leaders very cautious about the agreement. There's this American saying that you fooled me once, shame on you. If you fooled me twice, shame on me. So they don't. Iranian leaders don't want to be sort of see the same problem again, especially given the experience.
Like the Americans, the Iranians are actually studying the U.S. folklore and relying on some of the American folk wisdoms.
And you know, in Farsi, we have a similar saying. I don't know, my knowledge of Russian is not that great, so I don't know if there's something similar in Russian. But I expect, you know, this is a very logical thing to do. And you know, given that fact, the Iranian leaders realize that competing with Russia in the oil market is not going to be a good policy. I think the majority of Iranian leaders think that having some sort of cooperation with Russia, because this is what the Americans like to do. They want to push Iran to a position that the Russian government is not going to be pleased with, so they sabotage Iran-Russia relations. But I think the Iranian leaders realize the fact that competing with Russia on the energy market is not going to be something good, because no matter what Americans tell you, they generally don't do what they say, and they do other things. And this is the experience we have had with the United States in the last 40 years.
Now, the Iranian, the talks surrounding the Iranian nuclear problem have been going on for so long in various iterations that it's hard to understand what they center on for the time being. Are they still about your supposed intentions to have a military application of your nuclear technology, or are they essentially about the amount of pain that the West can legitimately subject Iran to? What is at the center of those talks?
You know, one problem, a major problem that we have is that based on the 2015 agreement, the JCPOA, the United States promised, and other members of P5+1, that they do not interfere in Iran's international economic relations. That's what Iran was supposed to get. Iran would get severe limitations on its peaceful nuclear program, and the other side would stop sabotaging Iran's economy internally or externally. And in reality, what happened was that they never really followed that article of the agreement, and then Trump left.
Mm-hmm. So now, let me just clarify for our audience. The agreement was signed, but in practical terms, many of the international banks still refuse to do business with Iranian enterprises. So you never quite reaped the rewards that were promised. They were on paper, but they never came to be materialized.
That is very true. And now what they want to do, what happened during the Trump administration was that they put part of Iran's military under sanctions. They called the military a terrorist organization, which has never been done before. And then they put that part of Iran's military under sanctions. And the aim was to sabotage whatever the next administration in the United States decided to do. This is what people like Robert Malley, who's leading the American team, was saying at that time. That the Trump administration is doing things to make returning to JCPOA very difficult. Now that these people are in power, it seems they want to continue the sanctions that Trump created. So there's this addiction to sanctions that you see people in the White House have. And they want to continue with that addiction. They want to keep that sanctions on Iran's military. And the problem with that is that this gives them a tool to basically sanction anybody in Iran as they wish, because they can just say that this person is linked to the military, and then that's how they sanction that person. So by keeping Iran's military under sanctions, they want to actually have a way of not doing what they are supposed to do under the agreement. And that's why Iranian leaders are very cautious with regard to what's going on.
Now, speaking about the Iranian leaders, you already mentioned that speech that Ayatollah Ali Khamenei gave a couple of weeks ago, in which he talked about the need for the Muslim world and specifically Iran not to be sidelined as the world moves or tries to take a new shape, not to be sidelined as many Muslim countries were after the Second World War when the current system was forming. How do you think the Muslim world or the Ummah, which let's admit is also divided across national, sectarian, political lines, how do you think it could bring its weight to bear on international politics?
I think what the Iranians have decided, and we are hoping that other Muslim countries do the same, is to actually have alliances and networks with countries that are resisting U.S. hegemony, countries like Russia and China. And so the cultures are different, religions are different, cultural backgrounds are different, but there is a common threat to the humanity in Washington. And U.S. policies are causing lots of difficulties for ordinary people all around the world. So this is the hope that we have, that countries that realize that, countries that have the option of not following U.S. lead. You know, there are some countries that are under U.S. pressure. We have in this part of the world, we have countries that have U.S. bases inside their country. It's difficult for them to make independent foreign policy decisions. But for countries that are relatively less dependent on the United States, the hope is that having a network and a coalition of countries that are going to resist that pressure that's coming from the United States and developing this culture of resistance. That's why a lot of people admire what Russia is doing now, because Russian leadership finally decided to say no to this aggressive policies that was coming from the West. And that needs to be helped. That needs to continue. And then our job in countries outside Russia is actually to join forces to make sure that U.S. hegemony is going to end sooner than later.
But Professor Izadi, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think any country can afford to take such a rebellious stance for cultural or geopolitical reasons. But what I'm also seeing over the last couple of months is that many of the old rivalries or enmities are being reappraised. There are many historical grievances between countries, let's say India and China or Russia and Turkey, Iran and some of the Gulf states. But I think these rapid changes in the international system that we've been discussing throughout the program today are forcing many of the countries to sort of think outside the box. Do you think that could also happen closer to your home? Do you think there could be any rapprochement between the Sunni and the Shia world to... That would be indeed a great step towards making the Muslim world and its weight on international politics felt.
You know, Iran has been trying to do that since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Iran has been supporting Palestinians, as you know, and Palestinians are Sunni Muslims. And Iran actually has been paying a lot of the high price of, you know, supporting Palestinians, especially with military technology so they can defend themselves against the Israeli occupation.
But the Palestinians weight in international politics, it's a very painful issue, but their influence is not that big. If we take, let's say, the Gulf monarchies like the Saudi Arabia or the Emirates, it's been very interesting to watch the subtle changes in their politics of late, how they relate to China, how they relate to the United States. Do you think there's any interest in that in Tehran, and do you think Iran can take it a bit further?
I think Iran has been trying, even before the current situation, has been trying to improve relations with countries like Saudi Arabia and UAE, because Iran does not consider them to be enemies. Iran's enemy is the United States and countries like Israel. So improving relations with the Saudis and UAE is going to be important. And also, as you know, in our neighborhood, we have countries like Qatar that have excellent relations with Iran. Qatar's Amir, King, was in Tehran just a few days ago. Iran's relations with countries like Oman is excellent. Iran has good relations with countries like Iraq and Pakistan and Afghanistan, other neighbors that Iran has. And Iran's relations with these countries depend on how much they want to follow U.S. lead. Countries like Saudi Arabia and UAE have been historically clients of the United States. And as you said, as they realize that the U.S. is a declining power, hopefully they develop a more independent foreign policy. And if that happens, then Iran's relations with these countries will improve significantly.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed for that as well as for the rest of the world. Professor, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.